We all notice changes in the landscape. Sometimes it can be quite dramatic changes. Others are more subtle and happen over time. For Matthew Stanton, who moved away from his childhood home at Crystal Cascades, the contrast was very stark when he returned home, and that was a change he set out to capture and interpret through the lens of his camera. It's not the quintessential picture postcard impression many of us might have of life here in the tropics. Matthew grew up alongside Freshwater Creek in the Red Lynch Valley, where the natural assets of the area are indeed the very thing that's attracted many thousands of people to live there in housing developments which have proliferated over time. For Matthew, living away and returning to his home made him examine those changes to the landscape in a way that he hopes might challenge our nostalgia and idealism of what it means to live in the deep north.
So this is a weird amalgam of the original landscape. So you've got all these giant eucalyptus pelleters here, but they look like rainforest trees because they're covered in rainforest vines. Some of them are invasive, some of them aren't. This track has only recently been cleared by the council down behind the subdivision, where it's sort of turned over about 40 years from eucalyptus forest to a weird hybrid forest of natives, eucalypts, exotic invasive gingers, exotic palms, invasive ground cover species. All within about 40 years, this has been completely transformed. But originally, this was all just cane paddock up there. And all along the creek, it was largely eucalypt woodland on this side and a mix of rainforest and water gums on the other side. You're right.
And there's a few occupational hazards. Yeah, yeah.
There's a hell of a lot of spiky exotic palms down here. Now, this is all arrowhead plant. I actually took a picture in an abandoned cane farming house back in 2015. It's the first time I became aware of the plant. It was sort of poking through the outside of the building to the bare floor on the inside, and the scene took me because it was sort of an interesting, seemed like a bit of an interesting metaphor for a lot of things with this bare ground in the house, and it's in the current exhibition. I later discovered that it was an invasive weed, but I hadn't really seen it around, and next thing I saw it everywhere I went, across the creek, carpeting the creek all the way down Freshwater Creek, and there's not much else can get up through it. It's sort of blankets the understory, and any native vegetation, native ferns or ground cover species that are trying to establish themselves don't stand much of a chance. Oh, there's a giant golden rod. So we'd wander down here. I come down here on our bikes, and all of the water holes we knew really, really well. And also when the creek was in flood, we'd leap off Freshwater Bridge in giant tractor tubes, and pretty much all wet season, that's all we ever did with our spare time. There's a big horseshoe that comes down around the back of the cane paddock, hooks right back around, back up onto the edge of Intake Road there, and we'd just scramble up the bank once we got to the end of the circuit, run a couple of kilometres down the road and do it again and again.
Is that what you remember most about your childhood, that freedom, Matt?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, very little parental monitoring, unless, you know, it was dark and you still went home, they might start to get a little bit concerned. But otherwise, up to the Cascades, up into the little rainforest gullies behind the mountains behind the house, and just exploring anything that caught our attention, really, that seemed sort of beguiling or alluring in some way. You might have assumed it would be a half an hour walk, but 5 hours later, you're sort of coming back, covered in cuts and torn apart by wait a while and, you know, blood dripping down your leg from leeches. But that was sort of just the way in which we related to the landscape, and all of our entertainment was really derived from it. So this path has just been cut by, I'm assuming it's the city council. I suspect it's a way of letting landowners know where their block ends and the council's land begins. As you can see, a lot of the backyards have spilled out onto the sort of upper bank of the creek here, and a lot of the weeds that have come from the backyards have also spilled out right down into the gallery forest along the creek. And here, you can see some of the blocks have just basically cleared right down to the creek bank. It's just bare, so it's lawn virtually right down to the creek. Some people have created personal sort of waterfrontage recreational areas, canoes, put seats, which is quite lovely, but it's interesting because it's all really changing the landscape of this creek really dramatically in so many ways. You can see down here, this is all Singapore daisy smothering the banks of the creek here. And amazing giant ficus virens here, which is one of my favourite trees along the creek, which lurches out over the top. And that's one of the things I remember very well from childhood.
I'm speaking with Matthew Stanton on the banks of the Freshwater Creek, which he's spent a good part of his career as a photographer capturing the essence of this landscape and many others in North Queensland, which have culminated in an exhibition which is on right now called The Deep North. When did you pick up a camera, and when did the challenge of trying to capture that through the lens of a camera start to manifest?
Well, I picked up a camera in high school, at Cairns State High School, under the tutelage of art teacher there called Anna Sullivan. It was in a black and white darkroom that they ran out of the school there, which is still there, and I visited it, which was really lovely to see that they'd preserved that. But around that time, I was connected to Grafton Arts, which was a very well-known community arts centre. And around that time, after leaving school, we were putting on gigs. You know, we were playing in noisy, probably pretty horrible sounding bands, but we had a lot of fun. And I started using the camera as a tool. I was probably a little bit more withdrawn than some of the other people. I think a lot of photographers tend to like to hang on the periphery and observe. So that's what I was doing. And then in the darkroom at Grafton Arts, which I had pretty much unfettered access to, staying up late, processing and printing. But I eventually moved to Melbourne around end of 1995. I've been sort of struggling to get into the photography industry somehow up here. Work trying to get a job in a mini lab and nobody would have me. I don't know. Moving to Melbourne was quite serendipitous. I started working for a well-known Australian fine art photographer by the name of Ponch Hawkes, assisting her, and then a number of commercial photographers. And then I worked with a bunch of what kind of been overly impressive prints that I made at Grafton Arts. I somehow managed to get a job as a professional enlarger operator in one of Australia's largest professional analogue film labs called Townsend's Colourtech in St Kilda. That was where I really first consolidated my skills as an analogue darkroom technician, but also became very, interested in how I might use that process for my own work eventually. Around that time, I guess I was coming back to Cairns, to Crystal Cascades periodically. And you notice just how quickly the place changes when you've been away. Even within 2 years, the changes were really, really dramatic, I was discovering. And I think the thing that led me to wanting to, I guess, engage with the landscape photographically up here again was probably the transition of all of the cane fields that used to line the valley into urban housing developments. You know, a lot of the landscapes that I was familiar with were no longer really recognisable. And pretty soon, it was not just the development landscapes that were catching my attention, it was the backgrounds that were really drawing my gaze beyond the urban environment. And I was starting to look at the different surfaces of vegetation, and I get what I saw as an incredible richness of psychological impressionism that I was receiving from those landscapes that I hadn't really paid attention to before. And I started to become initially very curious visually about them because they were so complex and so rich, but also so seemed so wounded and sort of forlorn as well. And I wanted to know more. The surfaces were impenetrable, but they also reminded me of portraiture in a way as well, because you had surface like a subject's face, and most of these landscapes are accessible only via the edges of creeks or where land had been cleared initially. That's the only way I could find these surfaces. But there was also all of this invisible space, which was inaccessible to the camera, but was also very present and sort of suggested through the work in the way the shadows and the detail fell away into those zones. And around that time, I also started learning a lot more about the ecology and the ecological history of the area. that in turn compelled me to start spending a lot of time getting information from people who knew more about that sort of thing, trying to understand what was healthy and what wasn't healthy, what was intact and what was despoiled, etc.
Matthew Stanton is sharing some insights and I guess a bit of the context behind an exhibition that you can see right now, Deep North, at the Northsite Contemporary Arts. And perhaps in that vein, it's quite apt that we are sitting next to somebody's kind of finely cut lawn and we can hear the lawnmower in the background and somebody has a kayak on the side of the creek. So these human interventions are things that you're also interested in. Would it be fair to say that not all of your photos then will be pleasing to the eye? I mean, you are literally not trying to take a picture postcard here.
No, I'm not. And strangely, my most popular images that are most pleasing to some people's eyes are the ones that are actually probably the most unhealthy landscapes. And I feel it's my responsibility to explain to them that I really love that you love the image because I wouldn't have taken the image if I didn't find it visually interesting myself. But it's also talking about our, I guess, trying to look at what our assumptions are about what a tropical, verdant, primeval landscape might look like and what we think it looks like and how reductive our idea of what represents that may have become over time. And I think that, you know, it's our tendency is we want to be comforted and consoled by the landscape and we sentimentalise the landscape, but we often don't spend a lot of time giving the processes and histories the consideration and, you know, and regard we probably should give to them. And I mean, I'm criticizing myself as much as, you know, a general sort of outlook that seems to have become apparent to me and may have been there all along. And it's probably improved in a lot of ways. But at the same time, I see the landscape unraveling just as, you know, if not more rapidly than it ever has in some areas and recovering quite dramatically in others. So it's very interesting for me.
Did you set out to make a conservation statement?
Not really. Well, actually, it originally started around 2006 with a what I would call a compact camera, which was a 4x5-inch view camera. And I was just trying to find a way through the landscape. I mean, I grew up, you know, surrounded by the stories and histories of, you know, the struggles to preserve the wet tropics. And I guess on one level, I am, you know, making a conservation statement. I think it's impossible not to engage with this landscape with the degree of immersion that I aspire to and sometimes achieve without becoming deeply concerned and unsettled about the things that you see. But it is like a poem for me as well. You know, the deep time or elements of the history of this landscape, it provides a backdrop for human activity, some of which is destructive, some of which is, you know, very much focused upon our role as ecological agents and the ways in which we can guide and support complex regenerational processes that would otherwise unravel without our help.
For those of us that might have held on to this illusion that being a photographer, particularly a landscape photographer, might be somehow glamorous, tell us just a little bit about the technical practicalities of capturing the images that you have, particularly using this camera and this large format that has become a part of your repertoire.
Yeah, well, it's very, I mean, it is actually quite a lot like a box brownie in some ways, because it's pretty much just a lens and a piece of film. The camera I use, however, is, you know, a lumbering sort of juggernaut. And I feel like it becomes an extension of me and I turn into a lumbering juggernaut when I use it as well and sort of traipse through the landscape. It's an 8x10-inch view camera. So the sheets of film are 20x25 centimetres in size. Mine is a very modern one. It was built in the 90s, but it's not particularly dissimilar to cameras that are around in the very early days of photography. Mine's made out of aluminium. It's very rigid and less likely to fall apart when I'm out in the field. And look, it's very slow to use. You spend a lot of time just getting to where you're going. I traditionally not traveled too far from the edge of the road when I first started because it was almost impossible to navigate the landscape with it after a while. And then at other times I've carried it at one point. We were doing some work with the Mendigubai Yidinji land managers down, so the land and sea ranges down about 15 kilometres south of Yarrabah, and they were doing some traditional fire management. And I was using that sort of camera whilst flames were sort of dancing around me. Admittedly, not particularly violent flames, but, you know, I had to be prepared to lug it out of the way at very short notice. My dark cloth smelt of smoke for the next 2 years. But that was one of the most exhilarating days I've ever spent photographing as well, because it was, you go to these landscapes, you take a totally improbable device into those situations, and it completely changes the way you think about how you make images and also the way you think about the landscape, because it forces you to slow right down, spend a lot of time just looking at things before you even set up the camera. And often you'll just walk through landscapes without it, take mental images, sometimes iPhone images, just sit with it and decide whether it's worth returning to those landscapes with the big camera. You usually feel pretty exhausted at the end of a particular shoot, even if it's just going down the creek bend trying to stumble over some rocks with a, you know, 35 kilo backpack and a tripod and 10 film holders. But once you get to the location, it's quite enriching, because you do spend a lot of time just reflecting and being in the environment. Technically, it's challenging, but you also just stop and look around and look very closely at things in a way that I don't think other camera formats would really encourage or support for me. Others might find that it would be totally unnecessary, but for me, I feel like it's very essential to this project using that camera.
As a local that has moved away and come back, you've had this unique opportunity to observe the changes in a more dramatic way than those of us that have perhaps seen them happening more incrementally as we go about our day-to-day very busy lives. What is it that you hope those that go along to view your Deep North exhibition, what is the one thing that you hope will resonate with them?
Hopefully, this landscape is one that is actually very strange and very, very complex. And there's all sorts of invisible forces at play that we aren't necessarily attuned to. And I think that just encouraging people to look more closely at the landscape and think about the processes at play is probably the most important thing, because that means that we can be talking about what's happening and more engaged and better able to care for it, and also recognise our place in terms of its preservation. But also just, I want people to be unsettled by it. I want them to be a little bit disturbed by it. And I think that's an important role that art has, particularly in relation to the landscape. And it's not really about disaster aesthetics for me. I don't necessarily think that I work within that paradigm. I usually try to work in a more subtle manner that sort of creeps up on people. A bit like Lorcaine. Suddenly you're drowning and you don't know how to escape. And you've either got to sort of, beat a path through the undergrowth or fly above it. You know, it sort of often feels like that with a lot of these landscapes. And I guess through observing it and witnessing these changes, you're forced to ask a whole lot of questions about what it means to look after and protect a landscape. These creeks belong to everybody. They belong to the animals that depend upon them, the azure kingfishers, the turtles, the jungle perch, all of the creatures that inhabit these areas, and their habitat is disappearing in many ways, and it's unraveling. And I think it's just learning where you are, learning its history, and learning how to best look after it, and maybe confront your own assumptions about what is necessarily going to be the best way to manage and be present within that landscape.